Okay, tonight we continue with chapter 8. Now, as we noted, we've seen six seals opened. And then chapter 7 was a parenthesis. And as we noted there, that's really symbolic of mercy in the midst of judgment. There's this break in the judgment, and we see the wonderful mercy or the grace of God manifested in the sealing of the 144,000, then, of course, the catching up to glory of the innumerable company. Now, in chapter 8, we come to the opening of the seventh seal. And the seventh seal really is the most devastating of all of them. And so in verse 1, we read, "And when he," and again, we are talking about the Lamb. He is the only one that has been found worthy to open the seal. So when he had opened the seventh seal, we have seen, as I said, six of them. And we'll see this, I'll bring this outline out just a little bit, repeat this a little bit later on just to get it in our minds. But the first four seals actually cover the entire tribulation period. And the reason we need to understand that is because that there's not just each intensifies more. In other words, you get the first four and then you intensify more, five, and like that they are opened at different intervals during the tribulation period. Because the first four actually cover the entire length of the tribulation period. 5, 6, and 7 just simply fill in the specific details and the intensity of those seals, as we have already seen and as we see more here in the seventh seal. This seventh seal, most of these things, some of it starts earlier in the, like under the second seal, I believe, but the most intense part of the tribulation period happens in the last 1260 days of that period. There are just horrendous things, and of course it is so bad that, as we have noticed before, Jesus said, "Except those days be shortened, no flesh should be saved." And so we find in these first seals that things have been devastating. There is no doubt about that. But here we come. When he had opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour. Now, this simply means the silence here just really means the lull before the storm. And we have seen that literally in storms, like when tornadoes come and then there's this eerie silence before that things actual hit. Well, that's just a hint of the way that it will be during the tribulation period. So there is just a little silence here before this barrage begins to hit those people that are on the earth. And it was about the space of half an hour. And that simply means just a brief time, perhaps just a few months or maybe just a few weeks that this existed before that things really began to get bad. In verse 2, "And I saw these seven angels." And again, these seven are simply symbolic of the fullness of that company. It doesn't just mean that there will be seven angels any more than there are just four, persons that would be called living ones, or 24 persons that would be called elders. They are representative numbers. And so the seven simply means the fullness of the angels that are they're actually redeemed humanity that are associated with Christ in his judgment. You can compare this with 1 Corinthians 6:1-3, where Paul says, "Know ye not that we shall judge angels?" We want to understand here that the angels are not the judges. It calls them angels, the seven angels. That word simply means messengers. And so we're not talking about heavenly angels here. We're talking about redeemed humanity. These are the ones that are associated with Christ in his judgment. And so these are those that have been redeemed, flesh and blood, that have overcome and have believed God, and they have judged themselves, and now then they are qualified to judge others. That's exactly what Paul was getting at there in 1 Corinthians 6, that we are learning to judge now. We judge our own selves now, and then we will be qualified to judge in that day. And so our judgment must not be based simply on our emotions and opinions, but we judge according to the Word of God. And we have to do that in our own lives. That's the symbolism here that we read. They stood before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. Those trumpets are the trumpets of the Word. That's their measure. That's what they sound out. That's how that they determine this judgment. In verse 4, we read that the smoke of the incense which came with the prayers of the saints. Again, we see a reference to the prayers of the saints, and it means exactly the same thing. These prayers are in harmony with the will of God. That's why God can answer them. That's why they are poured out. They came with these prayers. They are in harmony with what God wants, and that is a sweet smell unto the Lord when we are in agreement with Him. This is just another way of saying, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. We agree with what God is doing. And so this ascended up before God out of the angel's hand. And the angel took the censer and he filled it with fire of the altar. And of course, this angel, we miss verse 3. Let's go back to that, because we need to identify this other angel. Another angel came and stood at the altar. That angel is none other than Christ himself. He is the one who has the right to preside over this altar. And so he has the power of the high priest ministering at the altar, offering the incense. He came and stood at the altar having a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense that he should offer it with the prayers of all saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. Again, those are those prayers of saints that are in absolute agreement, full sympathy with God in what he is doing at that time. It was offered up unto God, as we find in verse 4. And then in verse 5, the angel took the censer and he filled it with fire of the altar. That altar is none other than Calvary, the cross. This is the standard of judgment, the judgment which Jesus went through there at the cross. That's the basis for all judgment here. John 5:27 says it this way, he hath given him authority to execute judgment because he is the Son of Man. In other words, he has been judged as a man. Now he's qualified as the judge. Jesus knows exactly what he is doing. He has the right here because he was already the one who was judged for sin and unrighteousness. And now then that same judgment, you see, is going to be used where men are concerned. So he took fire of the altar, and notice what he did with it. He cast it upon the earth. It is the judgment that is being poured out upon man. We have long said that if men do not accept the judgment that Jesus bore for them there on the cross of Calvary, they are going to bear it themselves. And it begins right here on the earth. And then, of course, we find later the punishment in hell for eternity. So he cast it upon the earth, and there were voices and thunderings and lightnings and an earthquake. And all of these are a result of that fire. That is the calling for judgment, those prayers of the saints. This is the literal threats, the thunderings and all of this. They're the threats. There's the noise of impending danger. There's disaster from the heavens, as we're going to find. Earthquake, and of course those earthquakes, as we're going to see, are actually literal. And we will see a couple of them in here. And they all tell us of those things that are beyond the control of men. This is the division that we see in many of these judgments, as we have already pointed out. There are some things that happen on this earth because men are so stupid, and because of their wickedness, and because they persist in warfare and things like that. They inflict man-made pain on others. But there are others like these, thunderings, lightnings, earthquakes, and things like that. These are things that only God is responsible for. It is completely beyond the control of men. Verse 6, and the seven angels which had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. Again, the representative of seven, not literal, but they are simply a part of that full complement that will reign with Christ in pouring out this judgment upon the earth. Verse 7, the first angel sounded. And this is exactly what we find here. There were seven angels, and each of them are going to call forth a certain judgment, as we are going to see in these next few verses. So the first angel sounded. He calls forth the judgment at this particular time, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth. The earth here, I believe, is especially symbolic of Israel. We know it includes the whole earth, but a lot of this devastation is specifically for the nation of Israel. God has to bring that nation to its knees in order for them to bow down and accept him as Messiah. But you will notice the extent of the devastation that was poured out after this first angel sounded. The third part of the trees was burned up, and all the green grass was burnt up. And this hail and fire could well describe nuclear weapons. We're going to see some different references here that I am certain that could fill the bill or describe the nuclear warfare that men are talking about today. They're terrified of it, and yet they continue to make their nuclear weapons to wipe out everyone else. We'll see more of that as we go on. But the hail and fire could well be a description of such nuclear warfare. We know that men are capable of that kind of destruction, and undoubtedly it will be literal. Now again, I wanted to notice that the first four seals cover the entire tribulation period from beginning to end. The fifth seal, that is the souls under the altar, that tells us of the martyrdom, as I say, but that will begin very early in the tribulation period. I think that will happen once the second seal is open. Then the martyrdom that we see here under the fifth seal will begin to take place at that time when sudden destruction comes. And then the sixth seal, we had that last week, and I'll reiterate it just a little bit here. That's in chapter 6, verses 12 to 17, where the sixth seal is open. And this will probably occur very near the end of the fourth seal, because we see the sun and the moon darkened, as we find there in Matthew 24:29. Now, the seventh seal, as we come in here, it records in great detail the devastation, again, beginning with the second seal, because that is, the second seal is a real key here, because again, when they say peace and safety, then cometh sudden destruction. And so some of this devastation that we see in the seventh seal will also begin fairly early in the tribulation period. So the seventh seal continues here with harsher events than what we see in the third and the fourth seal. That is like war and hunger and famine and poverty and death. And that will once again continue under the very end of the tribulation period. And again, as Jesus said, except those days be shortened, no flesh should survive. If God left man to himself, he would completely destroy the entire planet along with himself. But God will step in and stop that. In verse 8, the second angel sounded, and as it were a great mountain. And mountains in Scripture are symbolic of kingdoms or nations. And this says a great nation. How great that would be by comparison, I do not know. But I think we do have evidence here of a mountain that is capable of great destruction. Now, I personally believe that this great mountain, that Iran, fits the characteristics of that today. Because I think that's exactly what we are looking at. And again, I don't know just exactly when this might take place. How quickly after the sudden destruction comes upon this world. The way we are moving in this world right now, it wouldn't take very long in order to accomplish that. But what I believe is described here, what seems to be so graphically described here, is nuclear warfare. And Iran right now appears to be the nation that is just foolish enough and irresponsible enough to touch off a nuclear war just to get back at Israel. And as we have seen again and again, the primary focus of the entire tribulation period will actually be Israel. This is where that God will finally gather all of them together. The battle of Armageddon will be fought right there in the land of Israel. And so notice what we read here in verse 8. The second angel sounded, and as it were a great mountain, notice, burning with fire, was cast into the sea. The sea is symbolic again of these Gentile nations. That is consistent throughout the Scripture. And the third part of the sea became blood. That means that some nation, and I think it's going to be a rogue nation, it could be one of those nations that we see in chapter 13 rising up out of the water, but that would be a coalition of that seven end time nation. But I really believe it would be more of a rogue nation, because these seven are really trying to bring some kind of semblance of peace to this world, and they're not going to be able to do it. We know that. But I think we're looking at a rogue nation that will touch off a nuclear war. And notice the devastation of that, how far-reaching it is. It was cast into the sea. That means that these nations are going to be sucked in to such a conflagration. And the third part of the sea became blood. That tells you how devastating it is that a third of them, referring to the bloodshed around the world. Notice verse 9. A third part of the creatures that were in the sea. That could be literal, but of course it also speaks of the manpower and the men that are the people that are in those nations. So the third part of the creatures that were in the sea and had life died, and the third part of the ships were destroyed. And again, this could be very well be those literal armies and their armaments and all of that. So that's what they do it for, is to destroy what they perceive as their enemy. Verse 10, the third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven. Now, this is not hard to interpret here, because the great star from heaven is Satan himself. And you'll find him identified in verse 11. We're also going to see him further identified in chapter 9:1. And so this great star from heaven burning as it were a lamp. You can write down, compare this with 2 Corinthians 11:14. Because there you find that Satan has transformed himself into an angel of light. He is that even today. So it is referred to here in Revelation as it were a lamp, and it fell upon the third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of waters. Now, we know that Jesus saw this star fall. I think we have a reference on that here. He's back in Luke here in a little while. But anyway, Satan, we must understand at the present time, Satan is still in heaven. There are those that like to refer to Satan as being in hell, or and of course Peter talks about walking in the earth. But Satan right now is the prince and the power of the air. Satan will not be cast out until during the tribulation period. And we'll see really exactly, I think we have a mark later on, exactly when that is going to happen. But at any rate, this is a record of the great star falling from heaven. And notice what happened when he fell. It fell upon the third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of waters. These rivers of waters are symbolic. They were supposed to be channels of blessing. They were supposed to be refreshing. It tells us of the religiousness of Satan as he has transformed himself into an angel of light, and his refreshing, wonderful, sweet waters are going to be turned into waters of death because they have no truth, because that they are absolutely concentrated against the truth. People have been deceived by the angel of light. And that's what is meant here, that it fell upon the rivers and upon the fountains of waters. These religious forms are going to be shown up for exactly what they are. They are satanic. They are the teachings of Satan himself. And it is all of this deception through such waters that are really going to prepare the way for the false prophet to usher in the Antichrist. We'll see that more in chapter 13. And then you can also compare this with 2 Thessalonians 2:11. Because they received not the love of the truth, God will send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie. And men are rejecting truth daily and absolutely wanting no part of truth. When men reject truth, any part of truth, they lay themselves wide open to the deception of the enemy. That's why that we must pursue truth at all costs. In verse 11, this one is identified. The name of the star is called Wormwood. It means bitterness. And the third part of the waters became wormwood. And men died of the waters. Men died for lack of truth. Men died because that truth was not prevalent. We see that in this ungodliness of the Muslim religion and of Islam and all of that, denying Christ and his truth. And what do we see? Nothing but death. And we find the same thing of people even that name the name of Christ. But if they do not preach truth, if they do not actually have the truth of Christ, then death is still the result. Verse 12, and the fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, and the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars. So as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. Once again, keep in mind, this is a part of the seventh seal, the most destructive part of the tribulation period. This is the culmination of those most devastating events that are going to happen. And right at this moment, this is very important for us to get, because there really is a break here. We have had four angels that have sounded. But in verse 13 we read, and I beheld and heard an angel. This angel is not one of the seven. He is announcing something else. These others sounded and brought forth certain things, but this is not one of the seven. There are some that translate this angel as being an eagle, and that seems to fit with Job 9:26, as a messenger like the eagle that hasteth to the prey. So this is not one of the seven. The fifth angel does not sound until chapter 9:1. So notice what this angel says. I beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice. Now this angel seems to be somewhat after the pattern like of Philip. And of course Elijah of the Old Testament, he was carried from place to place. Philip of the New Testament, he was here and then he was there. This seems to be along that same pattern that you find there in Acts 8. But his message is what is so important. He cried with a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth, by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels which are yet to sound." So there are three angels that are yet to sound, and each one of them is going to introduce a different woe. When it says woe, 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 it is literal. There are three woes representative of horrendous judgment, each one of them individually, that is going to transpire. And so I want to give you just a little bit of an outline of these three woes. The three angels will announce them. The first woe is found in chapter 9, 1, verses 1 to 11. We are told that woe will continue 5 months. That will mean 150 days. Now, it is important also to understand this. When Jesus takes his throne, the times of the Gentiles will be over. And I mean that in literal time. In our months, the Gentile calendar, there is 31 days in some months and down to 28 in February. And every other year, you jump to 29 in February. All of that will be completely wiped out once Jesus takes his throne. When Jesus takes his throne, there will be exactly 12 months in the year, 30 days for each month, and therefore 360 days in a year. This is why that God can be so precise with his days. So when it says that this first woe is going to continue 5 months, it will be exactly 5 times 30, which is 150 days. The second woe is chapter 9:12 to chapter 11, verses 13 and 14. And this one ends, the second woe ends with the ascension of the two witnesses. That will take place in chapter 11, once again, verses 12 and 13. The third woe continues from chapter 11, 14 to the overthrow of the Antichrist. The third woe will continue then the last 1,260 days of the tribulation period. And so when these last three begin to sound, then you find out that begins to mark the most intense time of this seventh seal. All right, let's take about 5 minutes. We'll come back and go to chapter 9. Okay, let's go on to chapter 9 then.
Now, I will tell you just to so that we can kind of get a little bit of a semblance of time, where we are with time. The first woe starts 250 days before the middle of the week. Now, that simply means this. We know that the second woe ends in the middle of the week. That's when as we're going to find out in chapter 11, that's when the two witnesses ascend into heaven. Their ministry is over. Well, their ministry lasts 1,260 days. So that means the first half of the tribulation ends whenever the two witnesses are taken up to heaven. All right? If we start at the middle of the week and back up, we know that the first woe takes 150 days. And then the second woe, if it ends at the middle of the week, it has to end 100 days later. So 250 days between the first two woes. All right. We will see more of that as we go on how that is calculated. But we are very close to the middle of the week here. And so in Revelation 9 and verse 1, now the fifth angel sounds, and I saw a star. Now that's the same star that we see in chapter 8:10. Here we see more of the specifics of what he actually does. And so, who is that star? Well, it is Lucifer, the son of the morning. He's called that in Isaiah 14, verses 12 to 15. Jesus saw him as lightning fall from heaven in Luke 10, verse 18. He is the red dragon that is cast down from heaven in Revelation 12, 9. Now, when it says here that I saw a star fall from heaven, and then we find in Revelation 12 that red dragon is cast out, that's not two different events. He didn't fall and then go back up and had to be cast out. They're all referring to the same event. And so he is just called different names, different titles at different times. And then we will see actually when he when we see him, when he is actually cast out. So a little contrast here, and we've seen this over and over again, that Lucifer is called the son of the morning in Isaiah 14. Jesus is the bright and morning star, Revelation 22:16. And that tells you what Satan's always done. He's a counterfeit. From the very beginning, he has been a counterfeit. And so now then, we see him a direct counterfeit of Christ himself. So I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit. Now we find out here why he has been cast out, or rather what he's going to do when he was cast out. So this word bottomless, and I'm going to go into that in just a little bit of detail so that we understand hell and upper and lower Sheol and what that is, because we must understand what Satan has a key to. And so he has a key to the bottomless pit. The word bottomless means depthless. It means infernal. It means deep or abyss. And then the pit simply means a pit or a well or a prison, an abyss. We need to make a distinction here between hell and the bottomless pit, or sometimes we just read of an abyss. The departed spirits of the dead, saved or unsaved, go to what is called went to what is called Sheol. There would be upper Sheol and lower Sheol. Upper Sheol, and sometimes that is referred to as hell. I'll give you some verses here in just a moment. But upper Sheol is where the righteous dead were. They're not there anymore. They've been moved to heaven. But upper Sheol is where the righteous dead went after that they left this earth. Lower Sheol, or indeed the bottomless pit, is where the wicked dead would still reside. Psalm 16:10 makes the distinction this way. Thou wilt not leave my soul in hell, neither wilt thou suffer thine Holy One to see corruption. That is a picture, or the words of Christ. He did not go to the bottomless pit. He went to upper Sheol, and he did not remain there. It's Psalm 16:10. So thou wilt not leave my soul in hell, neither wilt thou suffer thine Holy One to see corruption. Ephesians 4, verses 8 to 10. Jesus went to lead captivity captive. And the captivity, of course, is those captive spirits that were in upper Sheol. And he preached to those spirits in upper Sheol, and he took them back to heaven with him. That's why I say that believers no longer go to upper Sheol. They go directly to heaven when they die, because Jesus brought them out of that prison. And some of them, if you read Matthew's account, some of those received their glorified bodies at that time and went into Jerusalem and appeared unto many. So that's what it means when Jesus led captivity captive. He led those righteous spirits out of upper Sheol, which was then in the heart of the earth, and he took it, that whole prison, back to heaven with him. Thus, the bottomless pit is all that is left in the heart of the earth. Now, this becomes very important. Why? Because Satan will be given the key to the bottomless pit. God never did give Satan control over the righteous dead. Never. And this is important for us to understand. God has always had them preserved for his own. Now, here are some other references that you might write down concerning the bottomless pit and lower Sheol and these. Deuteronomy 32:22 says it this way, a fire is kindled in mine anger and shall burn unto the lowest hell. That would again refer to the bottomless pit, and shall consume the earth with her increase and set on the fire the foundations of the mountains. Psalm 86:13 is another. Great is the mercy, thy mercy toward me, and thou hast delivered my soul from the lowest hell. Again, that is the bottomless pit. A believer is kept out of the bottomless pit. The term bottomless, or lower Sheol, but the term bottomless pit occurs only here in Revelation 1, 2, and 11. And again, we note here who has the keys to it. This leads us to the next point. How does Satan have the key to the bottomless pit? Jesus had to give it to him, because we read in Revelation 1:18 that Jesus is the one who had the keys of hell and of death. And so it is Christ himself that had to give the key to the bottomless pit to Satan. Now, when he will do that, I do not know. Perhaps it is just right here after he is cast out of heaven, and then Jesus would give it to him. That would be my view on the matter. I think if Satan had the key to the bottomless pit right now, he'd use it. Because you can't trust him anymore and you can't Iran. But anyway, I think it will be given to him after he's cast out of heaven. Now, getting back to upper and lower Sheol, the abode of the righteous dead was referred to as upper Sheol, or paradise, or Abraham's bosom. All of those indicate the same place, and it was the prison for the righteous dead. Luke 16, 23 and 26. You remember the story of the rich man and Lazarus. The rich man died and he went to hell. The Lazarus died and he went to Abraham's bosom. And we read there in those verses how that there was a great gulf between them. That is, between upper and lower Sheol. And one could not get to the other. Lazarus was in paradise or in the upper Sheol. And then again, Jesus led captivity and took paradise back to heaven with him. That's again in Ephesians 4, 8 to 10. You'll also find it in 1 Peter 3, verse 19. And now then, we read that Satan was given the key to the bottomless pit. He was not given to the overall abyss or pit. It was the bottomless pit, that is, lower Sheol, the abode only of the wicked dead. Now, verse 2, he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit, as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. This smoke and all of this air that was darkened by reason of the smoke, that is wicked spirits that Satan will loose at this time during the tribulation period. And why will he loose them? Now, people may think this is a little bit preposterous, but it absolutely is not. These wicked spirits are going to be released in order to inhabit the bodies of wicked men on the earth at that time. If you'll remember the story of Jesus, whenever he cast those demons out of Legion, they had to go into the swine. This spirit, evil spirit, has to have a body. And so they went into the swine. This will be demon possession on a monumental scale at that time, as we find here in verse 3. There came out of the smoke, that is, those spirits that were released from the bottomless pit, there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. If you'll briefly jump down, we'll come back to these other verses, but if you'll briefly jump down to verse 7, you will notice here that there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth. Skip down to verse 7. And the shapes of the locusts were like unto horses prepared unto battle, and on their heads were as it were crowns like gold, and their faces were as the faces of men. These evil spirits have inhabited the bodies of wicked men at that time. Let's back up to verse 4 and find out what these wicked spirits were sent forth to do. It was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree. The greenery here is evidence of that which is of God, that which has resurrection life, the only life that is on the earth at this time. You will notice it was commanded that these wicked spirits could not hurt the grass of the earth, any green thing, or any tree. What could they hurt? Verse 4, the latter part. only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. These wicked spirits are sent forth. Anyone saved, any believer, will not be hurt of these wicked spirits. It is only unbelievers who will be hurt at that time. Verse 5 is more. To them it was given that they should not kill them. Unbelievers at that time will be tormented, but they will not be able to die and escape. They're going to have to endure that torment. But they should be tormented 5 months. That's 150 days they will endure that kind of torment. And their torment was as a torment of a scorpion when he striketh a man. That means intense pain that these people will go through. In those days shall men seek death. And again, it is only the wicked men that are seeking death, because they'll be the only ones affected. And so these men shall seek death and shall not find it, and shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them. And again, the shapes of the locusts, that these same locusts that we found in verse 3, were like unto horses. And you need to underline the word prepared here, because we're going to find a difference here. These are just being prepared unto the battle. The real battle hadn't even come yet. This is just prepared to battle. And that's what the first woe is. The first woe is just a preparation for a battle that is going to come. It means the worst is yet to come, which begins with the second woe, as we're going to see a little bit later on. And on their heads were, as it were, crowns. And undoubtedly, these wicked spirits are going to inhabit those wicked men who are powers over nations. They are going to be real satanic dictators at that time. They had crowns like gold in their faces, the faces of men, which means they are men. Verse 8, they had hair as the hair of women. This is simply deception. They appear to be weak like women, but notice, their teeth were as the teeth of lions. And they appear to be real gentle and all of these things, and peace-loving and like women, but their teeth are like the teeth of lions. They had breastplates, as it were, breastplates of iron. The sound of their wings was as the sound of chariots, of many horses running to battle. They had tails like unto scorpions, and there were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men 5 months. Again, this describes what is going to happen during the first woe of 150 days. Now, these breastplates and their iron and their sound of their wings and the sound of the chariots, all of those seem to be to indicate the weapons controlled by these men. Airplanes, as we have pointed out before, looked like locusts. That F-16, is that the one? Anyway, where you have those windows on either side, looked like big old eyes of a locust if you look at the thing. And that's what we're talking about here, is these weapons of war, these armaments that they will go. Their tails are like scorpions, and their shields or defenses are iron, and then we see the speed and the noise of them running to battles. And then you will notice the stings in their tails to inflict great damage without killing them. That seems to be a reference to biological warfare or chemicals that disfigure their victims. And then in verse 11, this is not surprising, they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit. Of course he is. Satan himself is the one who is controlling them, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue has his name Apollyon. And then verse 12, one woe is past. See, the first woe ends here with verse 11, as we noted. And now then, one woe is past, verses 1 to 11, and behold, there come two woes more hereafter. Just to repeat, the first woe is chapter 9, 1 to verse 11. The second woe begins right here with verse 13, and it continues to chapter 11, 14. And so we read in verse 13, "The angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God." Now, undoubtedly, this voice would be Christ himself, and these angels, of course, are in sympathy with him. But you will notice here a voice like from the four horns of the golden altar. Those horns represent horns of power. And they, of course, their power that is going to be manifest in judgment. And these again, are in harmony with what God wants to do. But notice also, the basis here is his golden altar. God is measuring everything by that altar. That is Christ's work of redemption as he was judged at Calvary. This is how God is going to judge men by the very judgment that was poured out upon his son. Verse 14, saying to the sixth angel, and so now then it is time for the sixth angel, saying to the sixth angel which had the trumpet, "Loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates." This is the same scene that we saw in chapter 7:1. Over there, they're listed as four winds. The change here is that now they are called four angels. But the four angels here in verse 14 are exactly the same as the four winds that you find in chapter 7:1. And it means exactly the same. There are, over there, we saw four angels holding back those four winds. Now you will notice, loose these four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. That means that these wicked forces, satanic forces, are now going to be loosed to do what they want to do. They're no longer going to be bound. They will be unleashed at this time. And so these, you'll also notice the location, the great river Euphrates. That means it is right next to Israel. And so undoubtedly these four winds, or now they're called four angels, are going to be loosed in order to inflict whatever damage they want to do upon Israel. That's where it's all going to intensify, is around Israel. In verse 15, "And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour, and the day, and a month, and a year." And what's their purpose? "For to slay the third part of men." Again, we see the tremendous devastation that will be poured out at this time. Now, for a little bit more of a commentary on these wicked spirits and how that they are connected to the nations, you can also compare that with Daniel 10, verses 20 and 21. And you find those spirits that control both Persia and Greece. Well, these are going to have these angels, these winds, are also going to be controlling the wickedness of the world at that time. Now, what does this mean here? The four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year. Quite simply, it means a particular hour. God already knows exactly, I mean right down to the day, God knows exactly when this is going to take place, when these angels are going to be loosed. We know for a fact that they have not been loosed today, or they would go and do their business. They would carry out these satanic intentions. So it hasn't happened yet. But there is a particular hour of a given day, of a set month, and a specific year for this devastation to begin. God already knows what that is. And he is right on schedule. He won't be a day early, nor will he be a day late. The good news here is we will have been in glory for quite some time before this actually comes to pass, because the events we're talking about here will not come to pass until, remember, that first woe begins 250 days before the middle of the week. And again, the reason we know that is because that the first woe is 150 days. If the second woe ends at the middle of the week, that means the second woe will only last 100 days. So can everyone see that? I hope. All right. So we're talking here then about Satan will more than likely be cast out of heaven 250 days before the middle of the week. So we're down to a timeline here. This is where we are during this particular opening of the seventh, this part of the seventh seal. Now then, verse 16, our last verse here in chapter 9, the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000. And I heard the number of them. That means 200 million. And I believe this is the size of the army that will be loosed against Israel. Remember, these were bound there, Euphrates, where they couldn't do anything. Now they're going to be loosed. And this seems to be exactly what they are doing, is to come here, gather around Israel, and going to be loosed against them. So we have a 200 million man army coming against Israel here. What percentage would that be of the population of the earth at that time? There's already been a lot of devastation, but nevertheless, these are still listed as a 200 million man army. Now, the comfort for Israel and for us also, these nations can only go as far as God allows them to. Much of the damage is being inflicted on wicked, unbelieving men. Now, a good commentary on this would be Ezekiel 34:10. This entire chapter, Ezekiel 34, tells of the nations being the shepherds, even as Gentile nations were given charge over Israel. That's what God did. He committed the government into the hands of the Gentiles, beginning with Nebuchadnezzar. They were supposed to be God's shepherds, but they have not done a very good job of it. But God is going to call them to account for it. So they were given charge over Israel during these Gentile times, and God is going to hold those nations accountable wherein Israel has been scattered. Now, just for the sake of being aware of some teachings that are contrary to Scripture, there are some who point to Ezekiel 34, and because it says shepherds, they try to apply that to the church. But you cannot do that. The church is long gone by the time this happened. God is talking about the Gentiles being shepherds over his people, Israel. As we find there, Israel has been scattered among the nations all of that time. And God will gather them again. He will gather his people, Israel, from amongst the nations. We find that in Isaiah. You'll also find it in Ezekiel 34, verses 12 to 16. Now, the latter part of that same chapter tells of judgment on those cruel nations, those nations that were supposed to be shepherds over his people Israel. And they have afflicted Israel rather than taking care of them. Verse 23 of that chapter tells us that Christ will finally be, or he will finally take his place as being the shepherd of Israel. So when you read Ezekiel 34, remember, we are not talking about the church. We are talking about the nations and eventually Jesus himself being the chief shepherd over Israel as a nation. All right? Verse 17. Oh, another, I want to give you another reference concerning Israel and how that God is going to take care of that people. He is going to loose those spirits, as we've already seen, but God always has things under control. And as we've already seen, he can divide and he can see to it that these wicked spirits don't hurt the green tree or green grass or any of that. It means God is taking care of his own. Deuteronomy 32, verses 8 and 9. Is another wonderful verse concerning Israel and the nations. When the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. Israel will have their part first, and he set all the rest of the nations around them. For the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. Verse 17, and thus I saw the horses in the vision, and them that sat on them, having breastplates of fire and of jacinth and brimstone, and the heads of the horses were as the heads of lions, and out of their nostrils issued fire and smoke and brimstone. This again, you will notice here, the description of these in verses 7 and 9 is just prepared for war. Here they are entering into battle. It is actually coming to pass. It's the same description, but they're actually making war, as we find in verse 18. Now these terms that are used here, fire and smoke and brimstone, that shows the devastating weaponry that will be on display at that time and their ability to kill, it seems, three ways: the smoke, the fire, the brimstone. And we could describe that as nuclear warfare, germ warfare, biological warfare. All of those, you see, will be combined and included. And they have all of those today. There's some of these wicked dictators like Assad and Hussein when he was a dictator of Iraq. They've already used that even on their own people. So they're already there. Verse 18. By these three, that is by the smoke, fire, and brimstone, by these three was the third part of men killed. That's a lot of people. By the fire, smoke, brimstone, which issued out of their mouths, their powers in their mouth, in their tails, for their tails were like unto serpents, and had heads, with them they do hurt. That's the appearance, once again, of the weapons, even that are on display today. And the fact is, they can fire in any direction. They can move around wherever they want to. And the rest of the men which were not killed, notice this, by these plagues. And that seems to be a reference to the plagues brought out by germ and biological warfare that is designed to maim and such destruction. Yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils, idols of gold and silver, brass, stone, wood, which neither can see nor hear nor walk. God is still leveling his devastating judgment against those who deny the only true God. And those ungodly gods are all around the world. It doesn't make me any difference if they call him Allah or Buddha or whoever. These are the ones that God is going to pour out his wrath upon. Anyone that refuses King Jesus will be the target of God's judgment at that time. Verse 21, neither repented they of their murders, of their sorceries, nor of their fornication, nor of their thefts. And the thefts he must be talking about here, they have robbed God of his glory. They have robbed him of being the only true God. And when men refuse to worship the only true God, there will be a price to pay for it.